Mr. Standback here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when we have to remind you that we are listener-supported. And if you're out there in the listening audience, we hope that you want to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us in our endeavor to reach people across America. These are terrible and frightening times, because the truth of the matter is, those people who really control America have been working with the Chinese communists, in my estimation, since the days when Mao Tse-tung and Zhou Enlai were carrying out their communist revolution. Why? Why? Because they have a common goal. That goal is a one-world socialist system. The Chinese communists want the goal, the Russian communists wanted that goal, and the leaders of our socialist movement, our corporate socialist movement, want that goal, all dedicated to one new world order, one new world economic system, and a new world spirituality where Christianity and Judaism, as been traditionally known, will simply become a remembrance of things past. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we can document so many fascinating things here, and the interview you're hearing tonight is an important part of history, available no other place that I know. And, of course, we've been working at this for many years, and now we want to get the information out to the American people. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us to expand our coverage, and, ladies and gentlemen, we quite frankly need your money. We need to get on major markets in New York City, in San Francisco, in Chicago, across the nation. Because when we are on a market, the people in that area begin to think differently. They really do, and then they begin to reach others. And we've seen this here in the Monterey Bay area over the last 3 or 4 years we've been doing this. We're seeing this in Los Angeles now. We've been on there for 2.5 years, but we can't do it without your help. We do not have anybody behind us, but people who love America and are willing to make a personal sacrifice to help us in what we do. And so we hope that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and for a gift of $20 or more a month, well, I will send you the 4 best tapes in the month. We'll encourage you to copy those tapes. We'll send you our newsletter and encourage you to copy the newsletter and help us to get the information out. Time runs out for freedom sooner or later. If you are not involved now, then who? And if not now, when? So we hope that you'll call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and for a suggested gift of $20 or more a month, why, join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Give all that you comfortably can, because, quite frankly, we need your help to awaken the American people while we still have access to talk radio. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, let's get back to our interview with General Albert Wedemeyer.
Chinese national.
Well, then, do you feel that the imposition of the arms embargo was a major factor in the fall of China?
It was an important factor, a contributory factor, yes.
Did it have a demoralizing effect on the Chinese?
Definitely. It was very demoralizing, and the Chinese, I repeat, after 8 years of war, sacrifice, and so forth, destruction of their country, especially seaports and lines of communication, here they were experiencing the betrayal, you might say, of a friendship, a historic friendship that meant so much to them when the United States said, no more from us. You stand on your own.
Now, you were sent by President Truman to China in 1947, and that was the Wedemeyer mission.
Yes, he sent me out there as an ambassadorial mission, and gave me some so-called experts from the Treasury Department, State Department, and I selected a man from the military. And we went out there and made a survey of China and of Korea.
And you came up with a report, and that was a plan on how you felt it might be possible to save China from going communist?
Definitely. My mission wrote a long report to President Truman, and we did not suggest that American troops be sent to China. No. They had plenty of bodies, plenty of people, but we did suggest that we owed it to them to send equipment to them, you know, fighting the common enemy. I considered communism at that time a very dangerous enemy. As a matter of fact, during the war, as a war planner, I suggested to General Marshall many times that communism is still a dangerous, just as dangerous to us as the Nazism.
And what was General Marshall's reply to that?
Well, of course, the communists on June 22nd, 1941, became an ally, and I was admonished not to discuss any, make any derogatory remarks against that ally. I tried to use that, of course, as one of my stronger reasons for wanting to go across the channel in 1943 in lieu of 1944 in the European theater of operation.
What happened to your report when you returned to the United States?
When I got back, I was sent for by the Secretary of State, and he said that Mr. Truman was very pleased with my report, but he did not want it to be, it was to be classified, highly classified, as secret, and that I should admonish all members of my mission to treat it so.
And when was your report finally released?
Well, it never was released completely. One thing that happened, they gave me an office temporarily when I returned from that mission in 1947, and a member of the State Department came to me and said that General Marshall wanted me to delete certain portions of my report. Then it would probably be qualified for general distribution. I refused to do that. The man's name was Ambassador Butterworth, who came to me and asked me to do that. I told him that I signed that report would stand. That's the way otherwise I would not make any changes in the report, and I didn't. I went to General Marshall and told him what I'd done, and he acknowledged that I had that right.
Do you feel that your report was effectively suppressed?
Oh, definitely. But as time goes on, some of the report was made public, and really it was not overwhelming recommendation, anything unusual. I recommended that we continue to send material aid.
What, in essence, was in the report? What did you suggest to do to keep China from going communist?
I suggested that we continue to give material aid to the Chinese nationalists, and that we indicate clearly that we hope that they can do everything possible to establish the peace for which we all made great sacrifice. And I emphasize that I did not visualize American troops being sent there. They had ample manpower to take care of their problem, but they needed American equipment, which we had provided in abundance during World War II, but naturally, as ammunition is burned up, they needed some more ammunition in order to confront the well-supplied Chinese communists. They were supplied openly and amply by Moscow, China.
Now, why do you think that the American State Department allowed China to go communist? Certainly, our arms embargo played a significant part in this.
Well, I can't answer that question. There were people who were liberally minded. Some of them, I don't question loyalties. I question judgments. And there were men in the State Department in key positions, policymaking and so forth, who felt that maybe that was the wave of the future, that communism was would be very good for the American people and for the Chinese people. But I can't answer you definitely about that, no.
Who wrote the directive that General Marshall brought with him to China?
Well, I presume I'm correct about this. When General Marshall arrived in Shanghai, I met him at the airport, and I took him right to his hotel. And he asked me to stay with him while he was unpacking some of his effects. And he handed me a copy of his directive from President Truman. And I read it over very carefully. And I noted down at the bottom, JCV. So I assumed that John Carter Vincent, who was a key man in the Asiatic Division of the State Department, I presume he wrote it or dictated it. However, General Marshall approved the requirement that he amalgamate the descending forces over there, the nationalist Chinese and the communist Chinese and the intellectuals in the area. I explained to General Marshall that my reaction, namely, you can never do this, General Marshall. The communists are determined to get their power here and take over the country. And, of course, the Generalissimo is not going to relinquish one iota of his power. And General Marshall, who was unpacking a suitcase, turned to me and he said rather angrily, Wedemeyer, I'm going to do this and you're going to help me. Well, now, I thought I enjoyed the position that I enjoyed back in the General Staff, where I could differ with him, and he didn't seem to mind my doing so. I wanted to give him the benefit of my experience in China, and I told him, frankly, I didn't think it was possible for him to do it. However, I did give him key men from my staff, and I told him as much as I could about Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong and the other Chinese leaders with whom he would be conferring and negotiating and so forth, and assured him that I would help him in every way I could.
All right, sir. Let's go back to the time before the advent of hostilities during the Second World War. Do you think that President Roosevelt was intent upon involving us in the Second World War?
I definitely do. There's overwhelming evidence that indicated that President Franklin had committed himself to get into the Second World War. His problem was how to do it. Now, he had repeatedly assured the American people that no American boys would be sent overseas. That was a famous talk that he made. I can assure you, I repeat again and again and again, no American boys would be sent overseas. And nevertheless, he was making commitments, I think, with Churchill and taking steps back here in the States to ensure that we would get into the war. And certain acts, belligerent acts, were undertaken by the American Navy in the Atlantic area against the Nazis. Belligerent acts that they weren't justified in taking beyond... we were at peace with Germany, of course, at the time. But out in the Far East, he was able to place restrictions upon the Japanese that made it impossible for them to accept. I'm referring to the economy of the country. We were sending lots of scrap iron out there, and of course we were still not at war with them, but the Japanese just couldn't sustain a peacetime economy, let alone a wartime one, and so the Japanese were compelled to the surprise attack. Now, if Hitler had not declared war against the United States after the Pearl Harbor attack, the German people whom I talked to after World War II tell me that the president would have been hard put, because the German people were beginning, especially men like Count von Stauffenberg and others, were beginning to have some influence upon the Nazis, you know, not to involve us in the war. They definitely did not want us in the war.
And you think that the various pressures that we brought upon Japan, the cutting off of oil...
Definitely. I think the economic pressures that were brought upon Japan compelled them to go to war with us. And the attack on Pearl Harbor was the outcome.
Now, going to North Africa, you were instrumental in the planning of the attack on North Africa.
Yes.
From a military point of view, do you think that there was any advantage to our forces as far as attacking North Africa was concerned?
Well, as a military man, I opposed the operation against Northwest Africa. However, Mr. Churchill had a tremendous influence on the president. We were at war now, and in the winter of 42-43, Mr. Churchill thought that we should go into Northwest Africa and make sure that the Strait of Gibraltar was under Allied control. And furthermore, he wanted to push eastward from the landings that we accomplished in Northwest Africa and go after Rommel. Mr. Roosevelt approved those plans, and I don't think in general the American planners or American military authorities... Naturally, I cannot speak for the military policies and actions. I can just tell you the bit that I know personally as a planner. My plans would be moved on up to higher authority, and whether or not the top military men wanted to go into Northwest Africa, I don't know. They must have wanted to do it. Marshall made the decision to do it. He exceeded those plans. I personally didn't want to do that. My idea, my concept of strategy for the war was concentrate the decisive forces in the British Isles and go right for the heartland of the Nazi war effort, namely the Krupp works in Berlin and so forth.
You told me before a story about General Patton on the morning of the invasion of Sicily. Could you tell that again?
I was assigned to General Patton only as an observer when we went into Sicily in the summer of 1943. And I was on the flagship of the fleet that was assembled to take our troops to make a landing on the south shore of Sicily. The landing was to occur on July 10th, 1943. When we dropped anchor there off the coast that morning early, I had the stateroom next to General Patton aboard that flagship, and I had never experienced combat or a landing, so I wanted to do so. That was the reason I was sent over there, to observe and to participate and know what fighting was all about. So I went in to bid him goodbye, just knocked on his door. All lights were out. There was no circulation of air. We were very quiet, waiting to send our boys in to make the landing. And I had my war regalia on for the first time, tin helmet and so forth. And Patton was sitting at a desk, a table, in his underwear. It was very hot, July 10th, Mediterranean. And he stood up, and I said, George, that's his first name. I wasn't intimate with all generals, but he was a friend, and I'd lived with him for a whole month. George, I said, I just came to say goodbye to you and thank you for your courtesies and many kindnesses while I was with you. And he stood up, and tears rolled down his eyes. He had a Bible before him. He had been reading that Bible. And we weren't allowed to have any lights, but he had a little flashlight, a beam on the Bible, so I saw it there. And he was very emotional in saying goodbye to me. And I left. Ridgway was with me. And then we went down a rope ladder, went on a small boat, went ashore.
Did you have any difficulty getting distribution of your book?
I wrote a book, and it was published in 1958. The first one that enjoyed the bestsellers list for a year. It was never number one on the bestsellers list, nonfiction, but it was number two a few times. I was astounded, but it was well received. Suddenly it just stopped. You wouldn't find it anywhere, and there was no demand for it. The publisher sold 88,000 copies. That's the maximum sold. And my publisher, Holt, then permitted Devin Adair to take that book, and they put out a paper edition over there. How many books they sold, I do not know. The book was put in German. It was put in Chinese. It was translated into Japanese. And it's a textbook in the Japanese War College today. It was never picked up by British distributors. They refused the book. And I was told by people much more experienced than I in the publishing field that the criticisms I made of the wartime hero and Prime Minister of England, Winston Churchill, the criticisms I made there were unacceptable, and the British didn't like it, and they would not distribute it in England. So the book was never sold in England.
If America follows the same course we followed in the past as far as our political and our philosophical policies, what do you look for as far as the future of the survival of America as a viable nation?
Well, I foresee a breakdown, and I hate to use the word destruction, but certainly a complete neutralization of the high ideals that one finds, the basic ideas that one finds in our American heritage. It's in jeopardy right now, all out.
What do you think of the current military situation as far as America is concerned?
Well, this present administration has so frequently curtailed or completely eliminated from the budget the necessary equipment for a modern, functional military force. And this applies to all three of the services, but with particular reference to the Navy. So we are in a precarious situation vis-a-vis the ever-increasing strength, the military strength, and also the aggressive intentions for the use of that strength that we know exists in Soviet Russia.
What was the solution you offered in your report to the President of the United States?
There were two parts to the solution. I suggested to the President in 1947 that we not send any American troops to assist the nationalist Chinese, who were being pressed very hard by the Chinese communists, but we would send them ample equipment, send Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek proper equipment, appropriate equipment, to stop the onrush of the Chinese communists, who were liberally and amply supplied by the Moscow communists. Now, that was one part. No American bodies would go, but plenty of equipment to help maintain peace there. Then the other suggestion was that Generalissimo submit to the United Nations a request that a guardianship be established at once over Manchuria. The guardianship be represented by have representatives from the U.S., from Germany, from Great Britain, and from the USSR. And those nations would maintain the administration and the executive responsibilities of that area until the nationalist Chinese government could assume full responsibility for it. The other part of that for the United Nations was establish a trusteeship over Korea. And that the same membership in that trusteeship, and there again, my purpose was to ensure that no nation could take unilateral action to establish itself in power, especially, of course, the communists. That's what I wanted to do, to ensure that an opportunity, a free opportunity, was afforded the people in Korea and in China to determine how and by whom they would be governed.
And that report was suppressed?
Yes, that report was suppressed. I was told by someone in the State Department that part of the report was unacceptable to the State Department because it would embarrass the Chinese. It would embarrass Generalissimo. Well, I explained to them that I had cleared it with the Generalissimo. He was willing to do it, assuming that it was approved back here in the United States.
Do you really feel that it was the guardianship that was offensive, or do you think it was the fact that you suggested that we break the arms embargo, that we provide the Chinese communists, pardon me, the Chinese nationalists, for the weapons they needed?
I have no way of determining what was going on in the minds of certain people in the State Department. Anything that was in the American tradition for freedom, I felt, was suppressed subtly, but definitely.
Right, sir. Now, during the Second World War, why was it that our forces, that the British seemed to be supporting Tito and trying to do everything they could to play down Mikhailovich, who was the nationalist leader in opposition to Tito, who was the communist leader in Yugoslavia?
Oh, yes. Churchill felt that, and rightly, that historically, the Balkans were of strategic interest, importance to the British, and he so stated. And accordingly, he felt that he should determine our policies, Allied policies there, and he did decide to support Tito. One of his generals there, Fitzhugh, I think was his name, pointed out that you're supporting a man who's affiliated as a communist and affiliated with Stalin's crowd. He said, I don't give a damn. I'll accept any, the devil himself, in order to kill Germans. And therefore, he turned his back on Mihailovich, who was the true patriot in the area, and whom I felt we should support. And he supported Tito and persuaded the Americans to do likewise.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard an important part of history. I recorded this in 1980 at General Albert Wedemeyer's beautiful home. I believe it was in either Virginia or Maryland, but the home that had been built actually before George Washington was the president. An exciting opportunity to spend time with a man who is really part of history. Now, General Wedemeyer is long since deceased, but you've heard that interview with him, and you should have some understanding of why China went communist. But let's perhaps put a little different perspective on this. I'll never forget sitting in the veranda outside General Wedemeyer's house, and he looked at me and he said, Doctor, have you found a conspiracy out there? Is there a conspiracy? And I said, well, yes. And I told him about Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. In fact, I'd even sent him a copy of the book, and somebody borrowed his copy, and I sent him a second copy. And he was fascinated to read about the Council on Foreign Relations. But at that time, I really didn't understand so many of the other aspects of the conspiracy we faced. For instance, FDR, Harry Truman, and General Marshall were all Masons. And the Masons have always worked towards world government and have never really had any problem, at least those people at the higher echelons, of working with the leaders of world communism. But that, of course, is never talked about. Why did we bring communism to China? Because they are dedicated to a one-world government, the Novus Ordo Seclorum, that we are. And in fact, if you look on the back of your dollar bill, beneath the pyramid, the occult Masonic pyramid, which dates back to the pagan religions of antiquity, you'll find that slogan, Novus Ordo Seclorum, the New World Secular Order, the New World Order that every communist dreams of, every socialist dreams of, every humanist dreams of, every Mason dreams of, every at least the leadership of the Council on Foreign Relations dream of. And I should say not every Mason. Probably most Masons don't even understand what Masonry is all about or its occult origins from the pagan religions of antiquity. But the small inner fraternity does, and certainly those people within positions of leadership have many times talked about the fraternity within the fraternity, which is Masonry. And just as the same way, there is a ruling elite within the Council on Foreign Relations, within the Trilateral Commission, within the Bilderbergers, all aiming at this same ultimate goal, the establishment of a one-world ruling elite, a one-world socialist system. If you're out there in the listening audience, you've heard this, you have a question or comment, we only have a couple of minutes. Our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But now, after you've heard what General Wedemeyer said, perhaps you can better understand what John Kennedy was saying when he, in January of 1949, said, "Our relationship with China since the end of the Second World War has been a tragic one, and it is of the utmost importance that we search out and spotlight those who must bear the responsibility for our present predicament." And, of course, Winston Churchill was one of those. It was clearly enunciated in November of 1941 that the independence of China and the stability of the national government was a fundamental object of our Far Eastern policy. That this and other statements of our policies in the Far East led directly to the attack on Pearl Harbor is well known. During the post-war period began the great split in the minds of our diplomats over whether to support the government of General Chiang Kai-shek or force Chiang Kai-shek at the price of our assistance to bring Chinese communists into his government to form a coalition. Our policy in China has reaped the whirlwind. The continued insistence that aid would not be forthcoming unless a coalition government was formed was a crippling blow to the national government. So concerned were our diplomats and their advisors with the imperfections of the diplomatic system in China after 20 years of war, and the tales of corruption in high places, that they lost sight of our tremendous stake in a non-communist China. This is the tragic story of China, whose freedom we once fought to preserve. What our young men had saved, our diplomats and our president had frittered away. And in page 320 of Reminiscences, General MacArthur said this, "In China, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek was gradually pushing the communists back, being largely aided and supplied by the United States. For some unaccountable reason, the communists were not looked upon with disfavor by the State Department, who labeled them agrarian reformers. Instead of pushing on to the victory that was within the Generalissimo's grasp, an armistice was arranged and General Marshall was sent to amalgamate the two opponents. He went by way of Tokyo and stayed with me at the embassy. After months of fruitless negotiations, he withdrew without tangible results, and the war for China was resumed. But in this interval of 7 months, a decisive change had taken place. The Generalissimo had received no munitions or supplies from the United States, but the Soviets, working day and night, reinforced the Chinese communist armies. The great mass of military supplies we had sent them at Vladivostok during the latter stages of the war, none of which had been used, was largely transferred to the Chinese forces so that when hostilities were resumed, the balance of power had shifted." And, of course, that led communism to China. And the reason we have China in communism in China today is because of American foreign policy. Pray for our leaders. Pray that the American people wake up and understand the spiritual forces which are in control of our nation. Pray for revival and pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection.